All right. We're in it. Are you in it?
I'm in it.
Are you ready?
I mean, kind of.
Kind of?
I'm sort of ready.
Well, that's good enough.
I'm ready-ish.
All right. Well, then let us do it. I feel fairly.
You're prepared?
I mean, I'm here.
Are you emotionally prepared?
Never. I'm never emotionally prepared to record this show with you, Jamie.
That's fair. It's always a roller coaster.
It is.
Anyway, everyone, welcome to.
No, we are not opening the show with an anyway.
Fuck you, buddy.
Start it clean.
You start it clean.
Fine. I will. Welcome to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome!
A podcast about movies and wine. Period. End of sentence. No question. No debate. We all universally agree that this show, whose title derives from a famous movie dialogue reference, is in fact about movies and also occasionally wine.
Yeah, I have no rebuttal despite the fact that I want to rebut.
For people who don't know shit about one or both of those topics, he is Jamie. He is the wine guy. Say hello, Jamie.
Hello, Jamie.
I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. And we are here to help you have a better introduction to every episode of the show. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
And we will tell you and each other why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't. Today, we continue on with our lighthearted No Bummers miniseries. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I want wine.
And Jamie wants wine. There's like 12 eyes here in the outline for the episode.
It's true.
This is our ongoing miniseries about, you know,
the end of the world.
The end of the world, and me feeling pessimistic and depressed and feeling like the world that I brought my five-year-old into is doomed on a number of levels. We've already done nuclear holocaust. We've done the very unlikely scenario of kaiju apocalypse.
I don't know. A kaiju could end up killing us all.
It would be less unlikely than, I don't know, becoming president.
Why?
It's in the past, Jamie. Now it's safe. It could never happen again. There's no way he could ever be president again.
I am going to slap you in public.
Are you saying I'm tempting fate here?
I mean, he's definitely getting reelected.
Well, he's going to run again. Hopefully he dies before then because he's a f- Anyway, we did nuclear holocaust. We did kaiju apocalypse. We've done machine uprising / the destruction of reality by, you know, means of creating a huge simulacrum for people to live inside like slave batteries. And now we're getting to another of the pyramid of apocalyptic scenario movies. Alien invasion.
We love a good alien invasion.
I love a good alien invasion. I even kind of like a bad alien invasion.
Yeah, I mean, they're all good.
One of these days, I'm going to watch that Tomorrow War movie on Amazon Prime with Chris Pratt. All things about that sound not interesting to me.
But I know nothing about it.
It's Chris Pratt and there's aliens, but like from the future, and he goes and fights them.
He's charming and I like aliens.
Yeah, he is charming on screen.
Wow, all of your energy just deflated.
Sometimes. I just don't fully. Let's not talk about Chris Pratt. This was a mistake. Today, we are talking about one of my favorite movies of the last decade. This is 2014's Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Also known as Live, Die, Repeat, the title that the movie was remarketed as for its home video bow because its theatrical release was pretty underwhelming and the studio realized that they totally fucked it with a generic and bland title and they tried to rebrand it as something else.
It's a bad title. Edge of Tomorrow,
it's nothing. It tells me
literally
nothing. Yeah.
Nothing at all.
It's a nothing title. Live, Die, Repeat is something. The book that it's based on is called All You Need Is Kill. And the problem with All You Need Is Kill and like the producers, they sideline this, is that title is too cool and it doesn't match up with this movie. But Live, Die, Repeat, that tells me what I'm watching.
It's true. Although I feel like somewhere out there is a better title than all of these.
Maybe. But we got the title that we got, Edge of Tomorrow, Live, Die, Repeat, 2014. Directed by, he's not a journeyman, but directed by Doug Liman, who's had a weird career. It stars Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt. It's a sci-fi action alien invasion time loop war movie comedy.
That was a stunning string of words.
Tom Cruise plays Major Bill Cage, a marketing exec turned propagandist for the U.S. war effort against a semi-robotic alien invader known as the Mimics. Cage, a coward with no combat experience, is sent to the front line on the beaches of Normandy to document the invasion, where he and everyone else dies in a huge trap set by the aliens. Except Cage, for him, this is the beginning of a Groundhog Day-style time loop replaying the same day leading up to the doomed invasion over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. He teams up with war hero Rita Vertasky, played by an extremely badass Emily Blunt, to figure out a way to prevent the disaster by trying again and again and again and again to make their way through the battle. The movie is basically great on all levels. It's a blend of rad sci-fi action concepts and Looney Tunes violent comedy with two outstanding lead performances. It was well reviewed when it came out, but it underperformed at the box office. For scale, and this is going to sound crazy to describe this movie as underperforming, the budget was reportedly $185 million. They spent another $100 million marketing it worldwide, and the movie limped to $100 million in the U.S. box office and did another $266 internationally.
So they're $19 million in the red.
Yeah, but remember, they don't take all of the grosses. You get, on average, 50% of your grosses.
Okay, so they're much, much,
much more in the red.
$19 million in the red.
Yeah, they did not break even on this movie. We can unpack why, but I think the thing deserves a much better reputation than it has because it rules and is like, I don't know, it's just this close to being an all-time great action movie, and I wish people saw it. So Jamie, here, this is the movie's poster here.
Yes.
So you see it says live, die, repeat as like a tagline.
Yes.
But then at the bottom, in slightly larger text, Edge of Tomorrow.
Correct.
But one could easily look at this tagline or look at this poster and have difficulty deciding if the title of the movie is Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow, or Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt, in terms of like the very comparatively similar size of text.
Well, yeah, but I think that you would very much understand that the title of the movie is not Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt.
Jamie, I gotta tell you, in terms of just like baseline, like reptile brain, you know, responding to marketing, I would go see a movie called Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt.
It's true.
I would watch that movie.
Could be called that just based on its content.
That is extremely true. And then here, this is on.
Yes.
And then here's the Blu-ray cover.
Die, repeat.
Live, die, repeat. And very small at the bottom of the cover, Cruise / Blunt / Edge of Tomorrow.
Huh.
And the long-threatened sequel has a working title of Live, Die, Repeat, and Repeat.
Oh, my God.
Which I kind of like. I kind of like.
It's tongue-in-cheek. It's fine.
You had never seen this before.
No, I had not.
You had not seen it when it came out theatrically in 2014.
Nope.
You had not seen any of its home video incarnations in the year since then.
That is correct.
But now you have seen it.
Yes, I have.
Give us your thoughts.
I fucking love it.
Yeah.
Dude, I went into this movie, as I frequently go into the movies that you say that we should watch for this podcast,
right,
thinking that I'm going to like it. We have similar sensibilities when it comes to these things.
We have congruent tastes.
Yes. And also, you're pretty good at like pointing out the movies that specifically speak to me.
Right.
And I think when you described this as Looney Tunes, and
yeah,
Looney Tunes is like a touchstone for me.
Yeah.
And anything with anything resembling a Looney Tunes sensibility really gets to me.
Yeah. If we were to abuse a wine metaphor, if Jamie were like, I don't know, a fucking red blend, he'd be like a good 40% Looney Tunes anarchic sensibility.
That is correct.
Yeah. And then like, I don't know, 20% of like all the fuck you middle finger parts of social media.
Yes. Also that.
Yeah.
I went in with expectations of loving it, or rather of liking it, and I still kind of am not reconciled with how much I like it. I think it's fantastic. I think it hits all of the buttons that I like to have hit. It has suspense, it has action, it has cool bad guys. It has that Looney Tunes sensibility. And I think the thing that really sells the whole thing is Cruise and Blunt and their performance, their chemistry together. And then individually their power as performers. I think it's fucking awesome. It's so good.
Yeah. I am down with any movie that is able to get that many laughs out of
shooting someone in the face.
Yeah, summary execution. Every time Emily Blunt pulls her handgun out to exasperatedly kill him and put them both out of his misery, it's funny every time.
Like
and then when he starts pleading, he's like, I'm okay, I'm fine. Please, no, please, no, kablam.
Like the one time he breaks his leg and he's like trying to get away from her.
Limping away.
He's like hand over hand, like trying to get away using his upper body. And she just pops him in the head. It's fucking, it's so good.
It's funny every time. Every single time.
And it's able to have that tone while simultaneously have this incredibly dire, propulsive, we need to save the world kind of sensibility also.
Yeah.
And not have that be the, not have it feel artificial. Like it all feels really well knitted together.
Yeah. It's funny. So I knew that it'd be fish in the barrel to get you to like this movie because of the Looney Tunes of it all. But also because it's such a movie about video games.
Yes.
And the last time I tried to get you to watch a movie that was about video games that's not like an adaptation of a video game, but that's like something that's talking about how video games change our brains and stuff, was the David Cronenberg movie Existence.
Oh my God.
Which I think the big takeaway from that movie is like virtual worlds are a danger and, you know, they separate us from the body and from reality and from the flesh, which is like Cronenberg's whole thing. But
by the way, for the listener, Existence is... I don't even know what to say about it. You should watch it, though.
It's so good. It's super great. But it is a very bleak and like late period Cronenbergian like spin on the dread of video games.
Bizarre. And
also
weird.
A 1999 movie, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
But so this is about video games in an extremely positive way, right? And so that for anybody who is listening at home who like hasn't seen the movie, first of all, just stop what you're doing. Drop your $3.99 to rent it, or maybe it'll pop up streaming somewhere by the time this episode comes out. Check it out. The movie rules. Lots of fun. Big endorsement. But the Cruz character, Major Cage, he ends up on the beach. He basically is like a deserter who doesn't want to go to war. And then the general's like, no, you're going to go to war, and sends him in with this unit of like, you know, war movie caricatures in J-Squad. And we see him go through basically the whole like Normandy Beach battle, which very much looks like the way we've seen the Normandy Beaches depicted in World War II movies, right? Yep. Like it doesn't have the same bleach bypass, like high contrast look of Saving Private Ryan, but it has the same kind of like muddy color palette. And it's the same visual language that you've seen not only in World War II movies, but in tons and tons of video games. I don't know how many times I have played in whether it's a World War II game or like that's explicitly doing the invasion of Normandy, or like just other video games that take the military scenario of an aerial or aquatic assault on a beachhead, and then you fight your way inland from there. Halo does it in one of its key levels. I'm sure all the Halos do it, but like I've played that scenario so many times in games. It roots you in a very familiar video game scenario, and then what happens to him? He gets caught in a time loop, and he has to do it again and again and again,
until
until he succeeds. And just like anybody in a video game, he has to learn the landscape of the battle. He has to learn what the engagement is. He has to learn the rules and the abilities of the enemies. He has to learn how the bosses are going to move. He has to learn all the like little mechanics of it.
Yep.
And then by the end of it, not only is he good at like in a rote way of beating that one battle and beating that one encounter, but now because he's done it for... This is the same question like with Groundhog Day, of like how many loops does he go through? But right. You have to imagine it's thousands of them.
It's not as explicit in Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
It is full. It's pretty explicit here that it's like it's thousands.
Was it she Blunt's character, Rita, who had previously gone through a loop during a different battle and then lost the power to reset the day and loop through time. She says when she's referencing the character that she... They allude to like this character that she had fallen in love with over the course of her time loop scenario, mirroring him falling for her. She says that she watched him die 300 times. And it is like abundantly clear that TC and Major Cage have done this way more times than that. But yeah, like by the end of it, he's basically transcended. And he's like Neo at the end of The Matrix, right? Or Speed Racer at the end of Speed Racer. Like he's so fucking good. And like he's
the super soldier.
It's Halo. It's legendary, all skulls on. He's done the battle a million times, and now you can give him a video game controller and put him in any scenario, and he's good fighting any kind of aliens because he is the ultimate, you know, first person shooter action hero guy. So yeah, I figured this just like, because you're not really a gamer now, but like you were a huge video gamer in your youth.
Sure was.
And I thought this as like a positive reflection of like the things that video games can do for your brain and your worldview. I thought this might sit with you a little bit better.
It sat with me very well. I enjoyed it an awful lot. I will be watching it several more times.
I'm glad.
I just, yeah, it's going to become part of my cinema diet, I'm sure.
Oh, man. That's so good to hear. I love being able to help people find the things that become part of their routine. So this movie has come out since I've been on Letterboxd, which means every time that I've watched it, I have logged it. And me watching it the other night was the sixth time in 7 years that I've watched this movie. I've watched it many times. It's one of the ones that my wife likes to go to, like if we have, not that we have people over or like host things casually in the now times, but when we would have people over and be like, oh, let's put on a movie. What do we want to watch? And she has a short list of like, everybody will like this. We can always put it on and have a good time with it.
It's not baffling to me that this flopped, because we're going to, I'm sure, talk about exactly like why. And part of it is that fucking ambiguous nothing title.
Yeah.
But it's such a shame, because more people should see it.
Yeah.
And it should, this should be pervasive in our conversations of pop culture.
Yeah.
Like, we should talk about The Mimics, and we should talk about Live, Die, Repeat. Yeah. And Emily Blunt shooting you in the face.
Emily Blunt shooting you in the face over and over again. The Full Metal Bitch. The Angel of Verdun. Everything is extremely well named in this movie. Except for the title. Everything else, though, very well named.
I fully agree. I was caught off guard by how much fun I ended up having.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, it's a crazy tonal high wire act where, like you're saying, like, it's end of the world scenarios. The opening credits spell out for us pretty well with, not for nothing, very, very convincing fake news footage. That's something that movies get wrong so often when it's like, now we cut to CNN talking about the sci-fi scenario of the movie. And it always looks like bullshit. Like, all of this looks real.
It does.
General Brendan Gleeson addressing troops, who I think is just like his face, like facial capture replaced over like General Petraeus or somebody, like addressing actual troops.
He is awesome in this movie.
As he always is.
You know who else is awesome in this movie?
Is it Noah Taylor?
That's not who I'm thinking
of. Oh, it's my man, Bill Paxton.
It's fucking Billy Pax.
Bill Paxton. Oh, you're American? No, sir. I'm from Kentucky.
Motherfucker. His whole intro, I was gleeful. Yeah. I was smiling the whole time.
He's so funny. He's a guy who I think up until his death was still unappreciated. And he's just a guy who you could give, like, Bill Paxton as a leading man, I don't think ever worked the couple of times that they tried it.
Right.
But Bill Paxton as flavor,
oh my God.
Bill Paxton as just, you give him a small part. You know who knew how to use Bill Paxton is James Cameron.
Correct.
His boy, James Cameron. You give Bill Paxton a little bit. Aliens. And you let, I mean, in Aliens, in True Lies.
Yep.
In Titanic. He's fantastic in Titanic. He is. That movie does not work without that character kind of bridging the whole like flashback structure of it.
Yeah.
He's just, but in this movie, God, he's so fucking funny.
He's a thick black outline cartoon.
Yeah.
And I love every minute of it.
Yeah.
That fucking mustache.
I don't have anything to say. He owns that mustache. It is easily my favorite Bill Paxton performance, like, of his entire career. He's so insanely funny in it. Everybody's good. Like, the whole cast is great.
Yeah.
I have a few complaints about the movie. One of the biggest of them is that all of the, like, the squad caricatures of J-Squad, we spend a lot of time in the montaging of, like, Cage first getting assimilated into their unit and then, like, figuring out how he's going to make his escape from what is now his daily routine of PT and then weapons training and getting into the suit before the invasion the next morning. Like, he keeps finding ways to escape them. And we get a lot of like flavor of all the J-Squad characters. And then by the end, when we get to the, like, now he finally needs to go and convince them all to be the squad to join him on this like rogue mission to go and stop the time mimicking aliens. And then half of them get killed in the plane on the way there. And then, like, it's just like, that would have been an opportunity for those characters to really spark and add something substantive to the movie. And it just doesn't quite work.
Yes, that is correct. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It doesn't.
But other things do work extremely well.
They do.
In this movie's favor.
You have a small handful of things that you want to touch on.
Well, so, like, look, obviously, Emily Blunt is like the breakout star of this movie. And it wasn't the breakout movie for her. Like, she'd been on the scene for 10 years at that point. Like, her big breakout was probably Devil Wears Prada, which was 2005. This is almost 10 years later. But this is her breakout as an action lead.
Right.
And it is one of the most exciting action lead performances I've seen. She just owns the screen whenever she is on it.
With like, that Final Fantasy-ass sword that she's got.
Do you know what the sword is?
A helicopter blade?
It's a helicopter rotor blade that she fashions into a sword.
Of course it is.
Because she uses that more than she uses her gun. Yep. She just uses a sharpened helicopter rotor blade to chop these fucking alien robots down.
Well, the visual of her with that sword adds to the video gaminess of it.
Yeah, 100%.
It's like Final Fantasy vibes.
Right.
You know?
It looks like what's his name? Cloud something.
With the Buster sword. Yeah.
But so she rules, but I think she is great as like the conventional action breakout here, but I think Tom Cruise gives a genuinely masterful performance in this movie. And I know for some people that's going to be hard to listen to and take seriously. So
I fully agree with you.
Right. But just very briefly, if we can address the Tom Cruise of it all.
Yes, please.
And then put it aside.
Let's address the Tom Cruise of it all and then leave it.
And then put it aside.
Yes.
A lot of people have beef with Tom Cruise. It's very easy to have beef with Tom Cruise.
Well, he's kind of a buffoon.
Buffoon is a strong word, but okay. The Scientology,
yes,
is a problem. Best case with him and Scientology, best case is that he is an unknowing beneficiary of a lot of like crimes and human rights abuses. Best yes. case for him.
Correct.
His whole vibe of the last 16 years or so since the Katie Holmes situation and the jumping on Oprah's couch, which never actually happened. And there's a whole thing with that we don't need to talk about. But like his whole fall from grace from like the early aughts until now, he has not handled it well. And the way it's changed his performances and the types of movies that he's trying to make since then have not really ingratiated himself to audiences. I think all of that is fair. If he just kind of squicks you out and you're not into it, that's fine. If the fact that he is approaching 60 and continues to be in Mission Impossible movies and other movies where he plays like a guy and who's supposed to be in his mid-30s, he's not aging very gracefully. And if that's a problem, I accept all of that. But if we can put all of that aside and just honestly look at the performance that is here, Tom Cruise is one of the best who ever did the job in terms of like movie stars. He knows exactly what the movie needs. He changes himself when he allows himself to. He will change himself and his on-screen persona to fit what the movie requires of him. He is incredible in action, and all of that comes across here.
His performance as a coward in the beginning of this movie.
Yo, it's so exciting.
It really is. Because you see Tom Cruise, and you're never, ever expecting that.
Well, now you're not.
In 2014, you are not. He's not coward territory, right?
He hasn't really done that in a while. He had a mode for like, especially like post Top Gun, when he was like the biggest thing in the world, where he would do big studio, not necessarily franchise movies, but like big studio tentpole movies. And simultaneously he would go out of his way to work with the greatest filmmakers on the planet.
Right.
In 1999, which we just talked about a bunch in our last episode, he was in a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, and he was in the last Stanley Kubrick movie. Like, this was a guy who was willing to challenge himself.
His performance in
Magnolia.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's outstanding. He used to be a guy who wasn't guarded about his star persona. He would turn himself over to these interesting and idiosyncratic and individualistic filmmakers and say, use my star power and my presence, and I'll just do whatever you want. Like, I'll allow myself to be changed. And then he stopped being the top dog in Hollywood, and his movies, his grosses started falling, like the Mission Impossible 3 underperformed, War of the Worlds greatly underperformed. That was all part of like a sea change in Hollywood where the franchises were taking over and the franchise was the star and the star is not the star.
Right.
We're no longer in the era of the movie star. There are very few of them left. And if there are, they are explicitly tied to like franchise characters. Like, Tom's moment is fading and he has not handled it very well. And this movie, like you're saying with the cowardice, this was the last time that it felt like he tried to play a person who is not just an avatar or like a cipher for all the things that Tom Cruise wants audiences to think Tom Cruise is really like. For as much as I love the Mission Impossible movies, especially the last couple, the last three of them, that character, who was always kind of a blank slate anyway, has really just turned into like a collection of superpowers and attributes that I think Tom Cruise wants the rest of us to think that he has. I really think Tom Cruise wants the rest of us to think that after seeing someone one time, he could draw a very accurate, like, police sketch that on the palm of his hand that could then be input into facial recognition software and generate a match.
Yes.
This movie is not that. Like you're saying, he plays a coward. He plays a coward and a manipulator, a guy who will turn on anybody and use any ploy that he possibly can, any potential vulnerability or weakness to get somebody to do the thing that he wants, and which he is get him out of dying. He gets
his just desserts too.
Yeah.
Like immediately he is arrested and put to the front lines.
Yeah. I like in that first big, like long scene with him and Brendan Gleeson, General
English tough guy.
Yeah. But in that first scene where it is clear that the general's initial plan is just, I'm going to send you and a camera crew in with the invasion force to the front lines because that'll be good to sell the war and show people the way things are. And it's not to punish him. It's just like, you're going to go and do this thing for me.
Right.
And then when he's like, oh, general, I have to respectfully decline. And then he starts manipulating. And that's the point at which Brendan Gleeson's like, oh, fuck you. You're going anyway. And I'm going to make sure you die on that beach.
Yep.
But yeah, he plays all the notes that are unflattering. I'm just overwhelmed by the clarity with which he is able to communicate to you an extremely complex character's journey through time and repetition. And this guy who goes from being a coward to a reluctant warrior to a transcendent warrior to a man reluctantly like falling in love with this woman who he can't ever really be with, and he's trying to withhold his feelings from her because he knows it's not going to help either of them, to a guy who is self-sacrificing at the end. And then you get to that last fucking shot when he goes and he finds Rita and she's like, what do you want? Who told you you could talk to me? And he gives you that signature Tom Cruise exasperated laugh with tears in his eyes, smashed to credits. Like, the journey of that character, and it is all in his face and his eyes. Yep. And you never have any misunderstanding. You always know what he's thinking and what he's feeling through an insanely complicated and convoluted narrative.
It is.
And he's just like, it's an outstanding performance. It's unbelievable. And he hasn't done anything remotely this interesting since then. And I think part of that is that this movie was a huge fucking failure.
Which is such a bummer.
It breaks my heart. It really does.
What you were talking about in our last recording about being interested in a movie's success because it means that the people get to continue working. I think you can also extend that to continuing to do that particular thing or more interesting things. And here is that the counter example from The Matrix. Like, this is a thing that is truly great and was unsuccessful, and so we don't get any more of it. We don't get to see it again.
Well, not only do we not get any more of it, but like, we lose essentially Tom Cruise as, and people at home, you can snicker. That's fine. Jamie, don't snicker. We lose the last vestiges of Tom Cruise as the auteur of interesting movies.
Right.
Because whenever Tom Cruise is in a movie, he is the producer of the movie. And unless he is giving himself over to another filmmaker, he is largely like the chief creative voice behind them. And since this movie, the things that he is doing, he's just not ambitious anymore. He's not trying anything interesting. This decline for him, this like decline in ambition already started. This started with the successive like underperformance of War of the Worlds and then Mission Impossible 3 right after that. After Edge of Tomorrow, the things that he has appeared in, he's done two Mission Impossible movies. He did the really lackluster Jack Reacher sequel. He was in The Mummy, the attempted reboot of The Mummy / the attempted launch of Universal Monster, like Dark Universe franchise.
Didn't even know that was a thing.
This movie's incredibly bad, and he is catastrophically miscast in it. He made like a perfectly okay, like cocaine, like drug smuggler movie called American Made, which he's good in, but is like another performance where it's like Tom being great and high energy and all the things that Tom wants us to think about him. Then he's got a new Top Gun coming out, which is super not interesting to me. And he's got two more Mission Impossible movies. And then the movie that he will almost certainly die making, which is his follow-up movie with Doug Liman, who directed this. And it's them working with SpaceX, and they're going to do some kind of movie that will certainly lead to, yep, Tom Cruise died making a movie in space today. Tom Cruise was convinced that he was able to do a spacewalk without a suit, and it was recorded on film, and we'll all get to watch it in IMAX in a few years.
Oh my God, that's bleak.
But yeah, he's not taking the swings anymore. It breaks my heart.
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, his time has passed. Maybe it's kind of okay.
Well, now I just want him, I'm hoping that the speculation that Mission Impossible 7 and 8, which are like, we're shooting simultaneously and will come out a year from each other, is just him like, all right, I'm approaching 60. Let's get two more out there and then let's put it to bed. And then maybe he'll try and like be in movies for grownups again, because it's been a while. And I think Tom in action mode is great. But I think Tom, like, just as a dramatic actor and a movie star, is so fucking exciting. So aside from ranting about TC,
right,
the thing that knocks me out about this movie every single time is not just its story, but how it tells its story.
Right. Which is awesome.
It's crazy. The writing and editing trickery that enables it to like successfully make something super complex and confusing into something that presents as extremely straightforward and intuitive is like such a high ask of the writing and the direction and the editing. And it all accumulates to like grammar. The movie teaches you its own film grammar. And then as the movie goes on, it progressively reduces that grammar that is required for you to understand what is happening.
Yes.
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 All right, cool. I don't need to explain any further.
Great. No, I mean, I wanted to interrogate your use of the word grammar there, but you did good.
Grammar.
Yeah. This is the grammar of how it communicates.
The rules of how it.
It teaches you the rules of how it tells its story.
Right. And then as you get more and more comfortable with it, it is able to shed some of those rules as the movie goes on. It moves extremely quickly, and the progression of its grammar, like you're saying, like it teaches you how to watch it. It allows the movie to have sequences in different locations. Like, we're not just on the beach the whole time.
Right.
We'll do a whole sequence of him trying to infiltrate military headquarters, or a whole sequence of him and Emily Blunt in the training room with the cool spinning things that replicate.
The training
room is cool.
Yeah, it's so cool.
That is where most of the times where she executes him happen.
And it's great.
Or we'll do a whole sequence of like them on the road after they've gotten past the beach. And it allows you to do that without you needing to go back and reset every time. Like in the beginning, every time he resets, the movie has to orient you in it. So he dies, and then, all right, we're back with him waking up on the pile of bags. And then the drill sergeant comes up and calls him a maggot. And then he meets Bill Paxton, and then we go from there.
Yep.
And then he resets again, and now it's just Bill Paxton, and then we go in and we meet the guys. And then he resets, and then it's Bill Paxton, and then boom, we can cut to the next thing. And then we'll do a whole sequence of him doing, like, trying to sneak in and meet Rita and do the whole training montage. And then we only need to then reset back to Bill Paxton when we start a new sequence of him doing something else. Like, we start the next sequence of him and Rita learning how to do this particular bit of battle. And then we don't need to cut back to Bill Paxton to give you another reset. One of my favorites, there's a smart trick that the movie plays a whole bunch of times, and this is a writing thing and an editing thing and a performance thing, and this trick always works, is that they will start a scene with you thinking that it is Cage's first time going through a scenario, but then they'll quickly, or not so quickly, reveal that he's already done it, possibly a bunch of times before. Sometimes the reveal is for Blunt. Sometimes the reveal is for us. Sometimes it's for both. My favorite example is when they're in the farmhouse, right? We've seen them.
That's a good one.
And that scene is so beautiful too. Yeah. But so we've seen their relationship building, and they're finally off the beach, and they do like the cool like minivan chase. And then they get to the farmhouse and they see the helicopter in the back. And while they're looking for keys, and she's got a wound that needs to be dressed, and he's like, oh, let me make some coffee. And they're just kind of talking, and they're having this casual conversation, and she's opened up to him a little bit. And then he pours her the coffee, and he's like, two sugars, right?
No, you take three.
Yeah. And she just stares at him, and it dawns on her like, he's trying to trick me, but we've done this before. And the way that whole scene unfolds, and his like guilt in admitting it, but telling her like, every time we do this, you die. Like, can we please find another way to do this? Just lands on me so hard. But like, it's the trick. It's the reveal. And they do it again not long after that. She dies. he flies off in the helicopter and he falls into the trap with the Omega. And then he has to go back after a reset. And he goes to her and he's like, hey, it's not going to work. Everything that we think that we've been doing is a trap and it's not going to work. And we go to see the scientist guy played by Noah Taylor. And they're like, well, if we had this device that the general confiscated from us before, then maybe we could do it. And the two of them, it dawns on them, oh, well, if we can just use your video game power to figure out the best sequence of steps and evasions to sneak into the military HQ, we can get the thing and then figure out what the next step of the plot is. Cut to the two of them walking up to the military HQ, and now he's already walking her through it.
Yep.
We go from the two of them deciding they're going to do it, cut to, all right, now you're going to step left here, and this car from this embassy is going to be here. And now
we just understand that they've done it hundreds of times already.
Yeah. And it should be difficult, but the movie laid the groundwork by like incrementally explaining for you how the functionality works, that the next sequence after that, and this is where the movie is like full steam. This is the end of the second act. They convince Brendan Gleeson to give them the thing. They've got the Duber that they're going to poke into him to figure out what the plot is or whatever. It's a Duber. Some things are Dubers. And then that was a trap itself. And now they're trying to arrest them. And then they have to break out of the military HQ. And this is the first time that we start a new sequence, essentially, because now this is a new sequence of them escaping.
Right.
And we don't reset back with him. We get none of the grounding landmark images of him waking up at the boot camp facility, or Bill Paxton yelling at him, or him meeting Emily Blunt for the first time. Some of those like recurring right. visuals that always orient us. Okay, yes, you're resetting. This time we just jump into, it's a car chase and they have to escape the building. And we see that only two times, and then he loses the power. And this for me is like the disappointment of the movie, is that the movie has transcended and it became borderline abstract at this point, right? Like it is now still a linear narrative, but it's only taking incremental steps forward and it's repeating things to you and it's showing you the iterations without any grounding in, is this a reset? Where are we? When are we? Because they know that they've done it such a good job that the audience can follow along and it's completely understandable. It's basically like a better version of Inception, because we don't need you to explain it verbally to us the entire time as we're watching it, Chris. Because that movie, the last act, is transcendent because you spent 2 hours explaining it to us verbally up until that point.
I would disagree with your first point.
That's perfectly fine. This movie, most of the exposition is not verbal. You just watch it and you yes. intuit it and we experience it. And then when they reach that peak point where, like, again, Inception at that point, they've done all the groundwork of talking you through it so you understand what's happening. And now we can just go with the high concept, multiple timelines thing without any explanation. And it's thrilling. With this movie, they get to that point and then they take the power away. And so for me, it's a disappointment in that the tension and the drama and the heights of action and comedy, all of the things that made the first 2/3 of the movie so great, they have now taken away from themselves. Like all of the mechanics of what made all the scenes and the sequences work so far is now gone and we lose the grammar. And for me, we talked about this a little bit off mic, that like, that's why I think the last act is a little bit of a disappointment. I think it's narratively and emotionally like cathartic and satisfying, but in terms of the energy and the rhythm that the movie was creating, it peaked at something amazing and then just stopped and became something much more mundane.
I get what you're saying. In my watch through, I wasn't disappointed at that moment.
Yeah.
It felt natural for that switch to happen. I have trouble imagining a third act of that movie that is still him with the power.
How exciting would that have been, though?
It would have been. I don't know.
And again, I don't mean narratively exciting. I mean in terms of
yeah.
cinema, and just because the thrill of the movie is not just the battles and the jokes. It's the thrill of being smart enough to understand something that is very complex on screen, right?
Right.
Like the joy and the peak joys and thrills in this movie are, I think, the same as in Groundhog Day, a movie that has no aliens and no real action scenes. But like the thrill is watching him iterate and trying to read between the lines of like, well, between the last scene and this scene, like how many millions of years has this guy lived doing the same right. shit over and over again? I think that's the thrill that's missing. And otherwise, like the action ending is perfectly fine and perfunctory, but like, I don't know. I wish I could have watched the version where he continues to reset over and over again.
I don't know that I agree. I think that there's a stakes raising by taking away the power, because yeah. now he can die.
Yeah.
And he's really worried, and he's just flying by the seat of his pants, and he's never been tested in a way where he couldn't fall back on this power. I think it works narratively really well. And then we get to the end of the movie and I'm very satisfied and I like it.
I love the very end. The final like grace note of him coming back and meeting her in that little moment is just so perfect. And I love it. But it's the whole like third act in between there that I just find.
I'm with you on the team, them just not being used at all. They basically don't need them, you know? But I think the plan to like ride the plane basically as a boat all the way into the Louvre.
Into the Louvre.
Like, fucking rad.
It's pretty cool. I don't know. It's very easy for me to project outside knowledge onto a movie, like things that I know about production or whatever.
Right.
And this movie went into production without a finished screenplay.
Did it really?
Which just happens a lot. But this wasn't like studio meddling. This was the director, Doug Liman, who has a, let's say, very cavalier attitude towards responsibility towards his productions.
Sure.
There are tales about him just like walking off set to go play fucking paintball or some shit on other movies. Yeah. But they brought in Chris McQuarrie, who is sort of like, I don't know, Tom Cruise's creative muse or something, or maybe it's the other way around. He won an Oscar for writing The Usual Suspects, and he's only making Tom Cruise movies now. Like, he's admitted, like, I can't get anything made without Tom attached to it. But he wrote Valkyrie, and he wrote and directed Jack Reacher, and then they brought him into this late in the game to try and fix the screenplay, and then he did some writing on Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, and then he has written and directed Missions 5, 6, 7, and now 8.
Wow.
He's Tom's guy, and he wrote Top Gun Maverick, or whatever the fuck it's called. But yeah, he came in and like his biggest thing was the ending, that they just didn't have an ending that worked. And so they brought him in to help with more of the comedy, because Cruise was like, no, this is definitely a comedy, which is not something you think of with Tom Cruise, but he totally locked into that it was funny every time he got killed. And he thought it was hilarious to keep coming up with other ways for him to die on screen.
And it is, it's so funny.
He kills every time.
It's great.
But yeah, so McQuarrie came in and like his big thing was to just fix the ending. And it's a thing where, like, again, it could be me projecting, but I look at that ending and I think the visual effects in the movie are pretty exceptional overall. And I think the whole Louvre sequence just looks kind of like muddy blue screen CGI nonsense. Mm. It just doesn't look great to me. And that might be a result of any number of factors. But the one I think of is like, oh, well, we didn't have this planned for when we started production, and now we just kind of make the best of it, and we'll do it on a back lot with, you know, like a water tank, and we'll throw up some blue screens. And like, it just doesn't feel as carefully planned or as conceived of as like any of the other action beats in the movie.
That's fair.
All of which are perfect.
Yeah. It's not perfect. I just think it's rad.
It's cool. It's got some cool stuff.
Yeah.
Of the two movies that came out within 3 years of each other, in which Tom Cruise fights a semi-robotic alien invading menace that end with him in slow motion under the water, dropping a bomb into like the big Nexus alien and then like revealing the grenades as it all explodes. This is definitely the better of the two of them.
What?
Yeah, there's this movie Oblivion that has basically the same defeating the enemy, except in this one, he turns over and shows the alpha that he has all the pins from the grenades.
Which was an awesome beat.
Great little gag. And in that one, I think he just rolls over and like gives the alien the finger or something. Okay, but like, it's basically the same gag.
Great.
But anyway, yeah, it's a good movie. It's there's a lot of greatness. It's bordering on, you know, capital G great. And I think it kind of whiffs the last act a little bit, but otherwise.
I don't think it's a whiff. Maybe it's a foul off.
Foul off is a good way to put it.
Yeah.
It ends the movie competently.
Yes.
But they're not.
They're not going full tilt the way they were in the beginning.
Right. And I wish they were.
So can we talk about flops?
Can we talk about flops?
I'm interested.
About flops.
About flops.
Yeah.
Generally.
And things that don't plan or that don't pan out.
Correct.
Okay.
Things that get a lot of money spent on them.
Yeah.
And then don't see a return.
Right.
And then filmmakers and actors that are allowed to continue to make movies.
Right.
A, I guess, what's the deal?
Right.
But B, like, it seems to me that maybe there's an upside to flops. I don't know. So you turn me on to the podcast Blank Check with Griffin and David.
Blank Check with Griffin and David. That's right.
I love.
Yeah.
And am now an avid listener of.
Yeah. It's a podcast about filmographies, directors who have massive successes early on in their careers.
We're not doing a commercial for
Blank Check.
For Blank Check.
For one of the most popular movie podcasts out there. No,
right.
We're not doing
a commercial for it. It's great. And if you don't listen to it and you want to listen to more podcasts about movies,
yeah,
this one's great.
More shapeless 3-hour long podcast discussions where a bunch of white guys just bloviate about movies at great length.
Yeah, they're way smarter than either of us.
And they make better jokes too.
They do. Yeah. They're funnier.
Yeah.
But they're doing a John Carpenter miniseries right now.
That's right.
Or as of the time of this recording.
Right.
Not as of the time of this release.
That's right.
And that's a director that did not see a lot of box office success.
No. All of his greatest movies were failures when they first came out. With the exception of Halloween. But yeah.
Can you give me a little something on
about flops? The flops?
Is there an upside? Is this something that I'm imagining, that there could possibly be an upside? What is the, why don't we ever talk about the afterlife of films, meaning like post-theatrical screening?
Mm-hmm. We do.
But
in movie circles, we do. We talk about
it. It doesn't permeate to me, even through you. Really.
Yeah, but Jamie, last time you talked about a wine that everybody listening would know of, and I literally had never heard of it before.
I get it, yes.
You know, it's the 21st century, baby. Everything is niche.
Everything is niche. Especially wine.
Yeah.
Wine is very niche.
So you asked me what happens to flops. So, there's a couple things
and
that
happens to
flops.
And what happens to the people that make flops also?
Also, just to address flops, and to be clear, I should say, by a flop we're talking about things that are considered good, but financially underperform.
Correct. That's
not
what
just
I mean.
Things that don't perform financially and no one liked in the first place, right? Like Cats is not a flop, even though it was a huge commercial disaster.
Right.
But Cats, this is an example. Cats is a movie that failed hard, was very expensive, was highly anticipated. Like there's a big audience. There's a reason that show played on Broadway for fucking ever.
Yep.
Failed hard. And immediately became a midnight movie. Like during its theatrical run.
Midnight movie?
Midnight movie, a movie that like a cult movie that plays midnights in theaters. So like Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Okay.
Didn't make a dime in its original theatrical release, but flash forward less than 10 years later and it continues to generate revenue from late night midnight screenings. Here's a telling thing. They're always my villain, Disney. Disney bought Fox, right? A few years ago. Big discussion point for me and on this show, but just in general. And Disney immediately put the entire Fox back catalog in the vault, not just for home video, but for theatrical, which meant that movie theaters like mine, we could no longer book Alien or Die Hard or any of the thousands of movies that 20th Century Fox had put out. But those are two big obvious examples. You would call up your Fox person and be like, I work at Disney now. And no, we can't do it. They just don't do it anymore. They wouldn't let you book them the same way that you can't book Disney movies for theatrical re-releases, with one exception, and it was Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Wow.
Because the only way anybody makes money on that movie is doing midnight screenings of it, which like the Bourse Theater, which my former employer is operating now, the Bourse in Center City, Philly, they would do a midnight Rocky Horror once a month, and they would pack the house every single time. And that is in a city without a huge film audience.
Right.
What happens to a flop? Sometimes it becomes a cult classic or a cult curiosity. Sometimes they just disappear into obscurity forever and nobody ever talks about them ever again. But then the thing that can lead to a midnight movie status is there's some kind of reappraisal, right? A critical or popular reappraisal. Letterboxd, my beloved app where I log and list and track all the movies that I've seen, has a small, relatively niche community around the world. But I think it is telling that this movie is the number 4 most popular Tom Cruise movie on Letterboxd. Letterboxd is oftentimes aligns with the popularity of things in the general film discourse, if not the actual box office. So I find that curious. But why? What happens to them? What happens to the people who continue making flops? Well, I mean, we talked about it last time when we talked about the Wachowskis. They made Warner Brothers $1 billion with those 3 Matrix movies. And that earns you a lot of latitude to continue experimenting and failing. And they didn't make a movie that was financially successful again until, I'm assuming, Matrix Resurrections is financially successful on the scale of 2021 releases that come out in theaters during, let's say, hopefully not another COVID fucking winter, which it actually will be, right, and will be simultaneously on HBO Max, same day.
So it's mixed from movie to movie and filmmaker to filmmaker.
Yeah, sure. It varies from person to person. And there's some people who are allowed to fail and continue working. Not to be uncharitable towards the powers that be in Hollywood, but if you're a man and you direct a flop, you're way more likely to get another chance than a woman. You talked about Blank Check. They earlier this year concluded a miniseries on Elaine May. And Elaine May is a person who like made a bunch of movies, most of which didn't make a ton of money, but her last film was an enormous flop and there was blood in the water and there was went over budget. That's another thing, that something can be a flop and it can fail commercially, but there's not venom for it. There are some movies where something can fail commercially and then for whatever reason, culturally, all of our knives come out for it, right? So and like
why there's venom yeah, for Ishtar, yeah, is beyond
well,
me.
Well, but really, it's usually a hubris thing and there's a backlash.
Okay.
Right? So like Heaven's Gate, one of the most notorious like big flops of all time. This is Michael Cimino, the director of The Deer Hunter. And it's like a big, very expensive period piece movie that was not super well received when it came out. And it was a huge commercial failure. And that like sort of ended his career. And he really never worked too much after that. Waterworld is not as terrible as everybody remembers, but the reason that everybody pounds on it or jump or dog piles on it is because it was so fucking expensive.
Right.
The when the critics get angry about something and like decide that something is not just a flop, but a failure and you should be mad about, it's usually because of excess and hubris. The latest Marvel movie to come out, Eternals,
yeah,
from writer-director Chloe Zhao, who we recently discussed, and none of you listened to our episode about it, and I'm very mad at all of you.
I'm also mad at y'all.
Her Marvel movie came out, Eternals, like the reviews were bad, audience response is not great, but the way that the industry press has been framing it all is that it's a huge failure for Marvel and that there's this narrative that it's a failure for her creatively and that it's a sign that audiences are turning against the Marvel machine and just like all of these prepackaged ideas. And it's like, it's, I don't know, it feels like the tide is turning against Marvel a little bit, like they've been a little bit unambitious. And then when they do something ambitious like this one, but it doesn't succeed creatively, it's just like a ton of venom and distaste for it. You asked me if there's an upside to flopping, and I would say no, probably not.
Right.
Like there is an upside in that the people who love the thing will love it and cherish it and defend it, right? Like nobody like you and me who saw Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in empty theaters in 2005 has ambivalent feelings about that movie.
That movie fucking rules.
Right, but like we have ownership of it. Yeah. We love it. Why didn't you all see it, right? Like why weren't people there for it? But
it's a touchstone for us, and I will reference it in mixed company, and people will look at me like I've got three heads,
yeah,
because they've never seen it.
Right. But this is a movie that's had a second life. This movie had a second life on home video. It took a while, but there was a, not critical reappraisal, because people were basically on board with it, but like it, yeah, got a second chance. An audience found it, and I don't think it's as nearly as obscure as when it came out.
You mean Kiss Kiss Bang Bang or this movie?
Kiss Kiss okay. Bang Bang. This movie, so the thing about second lives is that they only happen in a world where movies are seen after theatrical. And the era of second lives for movies that are financially beneficial feels like it's over. Because what is dead now, Jamie? This is the thing I thump on all the time. What's dead in movies?
The theater?
Physical media. Oh,
physical media.
Physical media is dead.
Yeah.
It's dead. Austin Powers did not make really any money on theatrical, was a huge video and DVD hit. Austin Powers 2 gets greenlit based on that success and makes more money in its opening weekend than the first movie made in its entire theatrical run.
Right.
A lot of movies were given a chance for a second life, but in a way that is like financially viable, right? Mm-hmm. Like a movie finding a second life on streaming is fucking great for the, I don't know, pennies that anybody gets paid for Netflix viewership. Like who knows how this shit actually works out, right? But like right. A movie now in the streaming age, finding a second life on streaming, that might tell the studios that, oh, maybe there is an interest in this, but it's not in dollars the way it used to be.
Right.
It's not where like a movie can make no money in theaters and then become a consistent, sustainable hit on home video. Because the big thing is what you're asking is like, well, what's the upside? Well, is there a chance for the filmmaker or for the principals involved to continue making more like it? Mm-hmm. And now it doesn't feel like there's a financial upside. If you flop, you just don't exist and you go away forever.
That's sad.
It's weird.
I don't like it.
It's weird. And but like the dust is still settling. Like, you know, home video is straggling on there and they're all trying to figure out how to turn themselves into Netflix and how to stop being studios who make movies, I guess. While Netflix is simultaneously trying to be mega Netflix and also become its own movie and TV studio.
Yep.
I don't know. It's weird. Flops.
Flops.
Flops. But then, you know, sometimes flops. Flops.
All right. Well, I think you answered my question.
Hang on. Let me give you a turnaround there. Do you have a favorite flop? Flop that you cherish and praise and value for all time?
What the fuck are you? You mentioned Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Like, that was 2005, right?
Yes.
We were 20 years old.
Your math checks out?
Yep. I remember sitting in that theater and coming out so charged and excited and delighted by everything that I had just seen.
Yeah. I remember us tripping over ourselves, trying to remember any of the dozens of jokes that like you wanted to be instantly quotable. My brain was like, I can't remember all the great lines in that movie.
And now having seen it probably a dozen times since, I can quote it very readily. And as I said earlier, frequently I'll do the talking monkey bit to crickets.
Yeah.
Because nobody gets it.
What is the line? Talking monkey came from the future. Only says ficus. That's a good movie.
Val Kilmer in that movie.
It's a great movie.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's great. I mean, that's the one. I like to think that I would have said it even had you not brought it up.
You probably would have.
Because that's probably the one. Of any movie that I truly, truly love and cherish that was not successful. That's the one. What about you?
Pretty high up there. I mean, that's a touchstone for me. We just talked about the Wachowskis, but like Speed Racer. Speed Racer is just, and I'm ashamed. I didn't see Speed Racer in theaters. And I had friends who were like, yo, you got to go see this movie. I'm like, really? Do I have to? And then it came out on DVD and I was like, fuck, why didn't I go see this in a theater? What was I thinking?
That movie rules.
We'll talk about it someday.
Yeah.
We'll do a kids highlight on the show. Flops.
Flops.
They floppy.
They do. And this one flopped. So Scott.
James.
Scotty to Hottie.
Jamie to Jamie.
That's fair.
It's like jungle to jungle, but with Jamie's. That's, and no Tim Allen's.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I could do without Tim's Allen.
Can you talk a little bit for us about how this this particular movie film fits into your
the end of the world.
The end of the world as we know it, and I Want Wine miniseries.
Well, I mean, this one doesn't like, I don't get the deep dread from this one that I get from some of the other movies.
Yeah, Alien Invasion is pretty abstract.
Yeah, well, it's pretty abstract, and also there's not alien life forms out there, and I'm not really that worried about it. So
I mean, there might be.
Jamie. Come on.
There might be alien life forms.
Jamie, the Fermi paradox, okay? If they're out there, we're never going to encounter them. The universe is too big and too empty and time is too vast. It's not happening. It's just not going to happen.
Not yet.
Jamie, by the time they find us, we'll all be dead.
Okay, get on with it, motherfucker.
That's it. That's all I had to say. I'm not really worried about the world ending from an alien invasion because the world will have already ended by the time the aliens get here.
Okay, cool. Well, now it's time for the Bad Reviews game.
The
Bad Reviews game is the game where Scott has to listen to negative user reviews from the internet and decide whether they're about the movie or the wine that we're tackling in this particular episode, all while clinging to his last shreds of sanity. Surprise twist, though.
I don't have any shreds of sanity left to cling to.
No, the surprise twist is that there actually were not any bad reviews of this wine.
Come on, really?
They didn't exist. And there were very surprisingly few bad reviews of Edge of Tomorrow.
That's strange because it's a movie that people write about on internet.
Yeah.
And it has TC and people don't like TC.
I was shocked. Not a lot of bad reviews. So
yeah, what is the twist?
We're playing the good reviews game.
Oh, man, this feels nice. I like this.
This is the good reviews game. You get to guess what these reviews are about, movie or wine, and they are good reviews.
Oh, I like this. Let's make this the way we do this from now on. Let's have positive things in our life, Jamie.
I'm giving you this one.
Oh, okay.
This one time.
But how many positive reviews are there?
Well, I've taken to doing four.
Okay.
Total, but there were a lot of good reviews.
All right.
For both this wine and this movie.
Okay.
All right. First review. Love, 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 !! End of review.
Oh boy, that's real general. The wine?
It is the wine.
It is the wine. Okay, great.
Just love it. This is Lisa Gitchard, 4 stars, Vivino.
Love, 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 decibel.
I don't know, with that review, love, 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 and an !, why it doesn't get 5 stars. But
it's only one !!
That's
true. Are all of the loves capitalized?
Nope, just the first love was capitalized.
So only the first letter in the first love is capitalized, and everything else is...
lowercase.
And then an !!
That's right.
Look, I don't want to go off about a different kind of like actual grammar here, but if I were to do that, it would be either love, 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 all caps,
yes,
multiple !!
Correct.
Points, or... love, all caps, !! Love, all caps, !! Etc.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you.
That would be the way to do it.
Same.
All right. Good review.
Next up. Great. Highly recommended.
So this is not the good reviews game. This is the extremely general, nondescript, short 2-word statement game.
Yes, correct.
The movie?
This one's the wine.
The wine? Yep. Great. Highly recommended. Okay, wonderful.
Next up. So, so good. So much better than anything in this redacted that I've redacted in a long time.
So much better? Mm-hmm. So much better than anything in this redacted than I've redacted in a long time.
Correct.
So much better than anything in this either genre or region that I've watched or drank in a long time.
Correct.
I'm gonna go with movie here. Is this movie?
This is movie, yes.
And what is the first redacted? Is it
genre?
Is Jean?
Genre that I've seen in a long time.
All right.
Follows up with, they raised the bar with this movie. It reminded me of the way I felt when I saw classic big budget sci-fi action movies like Aliens or T2 for the first time.
I don't disagree, man. It's got that Bill Paxton flavor. Although I guess Paxton's not in T2.
He's not. But
he's
it
in
does T1, have
T1 though.
It's got that good. That good Paxton.
So funny. His character's thing about gambling, I meant to mention this before, his beef with gambling, right? He comes into J-Squad's
yes.
room and he sees that they're playing a card game. They've got it like under the sheets. And then he punishes them all by dealing them all cards from the deck and then making them tear them up and eat them.
Yep.
Did you listen to what his monologue is there?
His whole problem with gambling is yeah. that it supposes that that fate exists.
Exactly.
And that you are not the master of your own.
Right.
Yeah, future.
That way he says something about like readiness and discipline. Like with readiness and discipline, like you can basically overcome chance or probability.
Yep.
I just love like that plays thematically so well, and it's hilarious watching him make them eat playing cards.
It really is.
All right.
All right.
Digress.
Next one. Never wrote a redacted review in my life, but this one motivates me to do so.
All right. You don't have to tell me what the redaction is, but what is the category? Is it I've never written a this website review in my life or this type of thing review or
this type of thing review?
This type of thing review. Okay. And then what is the rest of it?
But this one motivates me enough to do so.
And it's a positive review.
Yes.
But you're not going to read
10
anything.
Out of 10.
You're not going to give me anything more.
Nope.
Edge of Tomorrow. Is it the movie?
It is the movie.
And it's
yes.
on IMDb.
No, this is a Metacritic. 10
this
out
is
of 10.
Metacritic. Because yeah. mm-hmm. IMDb, I know, goes for a 10 star scale. I think.
Yep.
I don't know. I don't ever look at that.
This person goes on to say, best movie I have seen since The Matrix.
Wow.
Check it out in IMAX if you can. It will put you right in the D-Day battle.
Wow. I mean, it will do that.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'd want to invoke
three out of four.
D-Day. Three out of four.
You did good.
I didn't do bad. You really threw me there, Jamie.
And because I can't leave you feeling entirely good, I have got an honorable mention, bad review.
Mentions. Great. Okay.
Just one.
Got to do one. And this is going to be about the movie, just to antagonize.
That's correct. Yes.
Proceed.
Take any of those countless obnoxious movies that rip off Groundhog Day, add references to every obnoxious sci-fi film made in the past decade, then add a bit of Matrix, Aliens, and Starship Troopers, and you get this stupid film. Oh, and don't forget feminist nonsense and quote-unquote diversity, irritating and boring beyond belief.
What feminist nonsense in that they have a rad woman in the movie being rad?
There is no feminist nonsense.
Yeah.
There's just a rad woman being rad.
I think there's a, like, not dystopian, but like it shows you what the stakes of the thing are, where there's just, it's very commonplace for there being a lot of women who have been drafted into this like war effort.
Yep.
Feminist nonsense. And then quote unquote diversity.
Yep. I don't know about that.
It's not quote unquote diversity. There are like some brown faces in this movie.
A small handful of them.
Yeah. None of them in significant roles in any way. This is not like the woke police beating the drum.
And no. So this person basically just wants to see movies about white men and only movies about white men.
Wow. That's a bunch of stupid bullshit.
It's really stupid.
Some people are stupid bullshit.
This one caught my eye. I just couldn't resist, but put it here to make you upset. Because it also makes me upset.
Yeah, cool, because it's dumb and wrong. And it's like they didn't watch the movie.
The lead up, though, all of these things are positives for me, right? Like the call to Groundhog Day and Matrix and Aliens and Starship Troopers. I'm like, yeah, there is some inspiration there for sure.
Well, but it's not ripping off Groundhog Day. Like ripping off Groundhog Day would just be doing a comedy in that scenario. This is synthesizing the Groundhog Day conceit and doing something
completely
radically different with it.
Yes.
Like, yeah, that's, you know, that's just writing.
This is how you do art.
Yeah. All right. Well, I can't. I just can't. I want something different. I don't want bad reviews game anymore. It went from being very charming in the beginning, and now it just makes me sad. Hey, friends. Future Scott here again. Wasn't that was a great conversation, right? Good stuff. Wasn't it long, though? Wouldn't you rather take a break right now before wading into Jamie's sea of wine malarkey? Well, if that's the case, I have good news for you. It's a two-parter. We're doing a two-parter. This is part one. Come back next week for part two. It'll be a rousing and equally lengthy discussion of Decibel Malbec. Spoilers, this wine is mega delicious. You'll find out if we think the pairing works. And of course, we will play the podcast game Wife Takes Apocalypse Edition. In the meantime, follow the show on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod and email any questions, comments, or suggestions to biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Please follow or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts. We'll read the review on the air. And now you can leave ratings on Spotify. So if you could do that, that would be super rad. Thank you very much. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson, that's me, and our social presence is the fine work of Jamie Harrison Rubin III. Thank you for listening, and we will be back in a week for more of our bullshit. Please tune in again. Thank you so much. In the meantime, watch more movies, drink more wine. It's good for you. Like, probably. That's more Jamie's thing. Godspeed. Stay safe out there, everybody. You're fucking dodging Omicron left and right, all right? It's like an obstacle course. You're on the beaches of Normandy, and it's just Omicron everywhere, and there's Omicron flak and Omicron mortars and fucking Omicron explosions and debris, and Jamie's over there. Stay safe, everybody, all right? Love you. Bye.